In 1868, author Louisa May Alcott was asked if she was interested in writing a book for and about girls. Her response, as recorded in her journal, was, "Never liked girls, or knew many, except my sisters." She did go on to write about four sisters, and the resulting novel, Little Women, has transcended time and place to become one of the most popular books in the world. And this year it celebrates 150 years in print. But of course the story has also been told through films, television, opera. There have been spin-offs, updates, prequels, sequels from Europe to Africa to Asia. And my friend Gillian Armstrong, of course, made one from an Australian viewpoint. This year sees another BBC series based on the book, and there are plans for yet another film. Why has the story had such an impact? Now, the question is at the heart of a new book titled Meg, Jo, Beth and Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters by Anne Boyd-Rue. Anne's a professor at the University of New Orleans, a city we know well and love from our time there, post-Katrina. Anne joins me now, and I welcome her to our little wireless program. Anne, you were a latecomer to the book. You didn't read it until you were in your 20s. Why were you so recalcitrant?
Well, I'm not sure exactly, but it wasn't something that was handed down to me by my mother or grandmother. My grandmother died before I was born, so maybe that has something to do with it. But I've discovered in my research, talking to lots of other fans all over the world, that many of them were given the book by mother, grandmother, an aunt, or librarian, or teacher. And for whatever reason, nobody put it into my hands. It was put into my hands, so to speak, by a professor when I was in graduate school. And even though I've long since regretted that I wasn't able to read it as a child and have its influence on me as when I was younger, it still had a tremendous impact on me, even in my 20s.
And describe the impact.
Well, in my early 20s, I was in graduate school. And I guess you could say I was in graduate school because I still didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I was trying to figure that out. And in many ways, I was kind of at the same place Jo was at in the second half of the book, trying to find my place in the world and figure out, you know, would I be able to have the career I wanted? Would I be able to write books? Would I be able to have a family as well? And to see her working through those issues in 1868 really resonated with me, because that wasn't something I was noticing in other literature of the period. Which was the period I had come to graduate school to study. So Jo was a revelation to me, and I carried her with me for quite a while, as well as her creator. Jo led me to Alcott herself, and I became quite inspired by her, wrote about her in my first book. And I named my daughter when she was born about 10 years later. I gave her the middle name Josephine.
It also tweaked your professional interest as an academic.
It did. Absolutely. Jo was a revelation to me, not only because, you know, I identified with her, but also because she's an extremely positive role model for a woman writer, which is something I did not find anywhere else in 19th century literature. I was interested in understanding when exactly American women writers had developed serious ambitions as writers. You know, along the lines of what we saw, what you saw earlier in the century, say in Charlotte Bronte, the Bronte sisters generally. You know, when did American women start developing that ambition? And it was really around the time that Louisa wrote Little Women. So in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and I wrote about a group of women who were many of them very tortured about the fact that they had these ambitions at all, that were considered so unladylike, that they thought that their ambitions had unsexed them. They did not hide behind pseudonyms the way the Bronte sisters did, but they might as well have, because they were so tortured about this. Louisa May Alcott wasn't, and Jo as a character is not. She is emphatically proud of her ambition, and her family supports her, her friends support her. Even Laurie does. And so I think that the role model that she provides has really resonated, not just with me, but, you know, hundreds, millions of women around the world, and so many of whom have gone on to become writers themselves.
I'm going to read some of your text here. I've discovered that Olcott's novel is not what it at first appears to be. What seems like a tale from a simpler time turns out to be the product of a difficult and sometimes troubled life. What appears to be a sweet, light story of four girls growing up is also very much about how hard it was and is, and I emphasise that, and is, to come of an age in a culture that prizes a woman's appearance over her substance. So 150 years passes in the twinkling of an eye, doesn't it?
Well, in some ways it does. I mean, to read the book, in a sense, it's like time travel going back to the 1860s. But in many ways, I think that what the March sisters are experiencing, Joe in particular, is what so many girls are still struggling with today. And Meg as well, as she, you know, figures out how to become a young woman, goes to Vanity Fair and, you know, gets all dressed up and starts being ogled by men. And, you know, Joe is resisting, you know, having to adopt the trappings of becoming a young lady, wearing long skirts, putting her hair up, not being able to run and express herself freely anymore. So these are sort of suggestions of what it meant to become a woman in the 19th century. But what the book, I think, really shows is how much gender is something that is learned. It's something that we have to adapt to. It's not necessarily innate. And this is something that I think we're becoming more and more aware of now. And young women are still dealing with. And I think it is extremely telling that Jo March, who's probably the most popular literary heroine, young girl heroine ever, didn't want to be a girl at all. She wanted to be a boy. And what does that say then about how conflicted so many girls and women have felt about their gender identity?
Now, Louisa May Alcott was an unconventional woman, and part of that is due to her family background. I was astonished and appalled by the portrait of Bronson, Alcott, dad, friends with Thoreau and Emerson, and he wanted very much to live off-grid to the extent that at one point he was opposed to eating vegetables because they pointed to hell.
If they growed underground, right? Yeah, so he preferred fruits that grew on trees, vegetables, things that grew above ground. Yeah, he was extremely ideologically driven. He had very strict religious ideals that most people thought were very extreme, and we would still today consider rather extreme. But his sort of monomania, if you can call it that, destabilized their family and made it quite difficult for them to live comfortably and stably. They moved about 30 different times before Louisa was in her mid-20s. I mean, that's astonishing. I mean, this is a family that was constantly being separated. The girls were being sent off to live with family members because they were so poor, they couldn't take care of all of them. And this threat of separation looms over Little Women. And even though it's a novel that we consider to be, you know, sort of the epitome of the nuclear family, of family life, traditional ideas of family, it's really a family that is constantly under threat of separating. And in fact, that is what happens in part two. You know, the father's the one who's away in the first part, but in the second part, it's the girls who all go off in different directions. And it's really a story about what happens to families as they grow and change. And she experienced that from a very young age.
This is Ellie Nell on RN, and I'm talking to Anne Boyd-Rue about Little Women. Now, in Little Women, the father is as absent as he effectively was in real life, but he's at war. And that reminds us of what a turbulent time the book is set in.
Right. Yes, I think that backdrop, even though it does really just play the role of a backdrop, provides a context for the book that still resonates at times of, you know, tremendous division were kind of, it's interesting because if I looked back at the centennial of the novel in 1868 or 1968, there were discussions then about how the novel sort of resonated newly in a time of tremendous cultural and social division. And it's, I think it's interesting that we're hitting the sesquicentennial at another time of tremendous division. The novel, as I said, is very much about the threat of separation in families, but I think it reflects also the sort of larger cultural national instability that has always been at the heart of American life.
Tell me about Louise's mother, Abba. How did she cope with her problematic husband?
Well, not well at times, it seems. Unfortunately, most of Abigail's diaries, personal writings, were destroyed, apparently at her own request. And some of them have survived enough to give us a sense that it was a very difficult life for her. And I think that's reflected in Little Women. There's a very telling scene where Jo March is very worried about her temper. She's, you know, she's worried about what she might do. She has just let Amy fall through the ice because she was so angry with her. And she tells Marmee, "You don't understand what it's like." And Marmee tells her, "Actually, I do. I know exactly what it's like because I am angry almost every day of my life." And that's quite remarkable for a woman, for a female character to admit in the 19th century and even well into the 20th century. And even today, I think women writers are finally able to express their anger in a way that was just impossible for decades. And there it is in Little Women, in a passage that is often overlooked, but it's a remarkable passage and I think reflects the great difficulties that Abigail endured.
It's interesting, isn't it, Anne, that whilst read by countless women, it's not a book that is often read by men.
Well, not so much anymore. I've met many men who've told me that they've read the book, but they do seem to be the exception. It seems that in earlier generations, because the novel was so ubiquitous, and the whole series, it's a trilogy, right? She wrote two follow-up novels, Little Men and Joe's Boys. And Little Men was a book that boys often read. Of course, you know, the title would suggest it was a book for them. And many boys talk about having liked it so much, then they went back to read Little Women. And so there's, I think, the sort of very severe gender segregation in our literature, particularly children's literature. It's not a new phenomenon, but it's become even more segregated, I think, to the extent where it's almost impossible to imagine a little boy picking up a book like Little Women. Although I will say, and as I do talk about in the book, I did successfully introduce the book to some boys and some in an elementary English class or middle school English class here in my hometown, and they happily read the book and discussed it with each other, and nobody teased them about it. And I think if it's introduced in the right way, that boys can find themselves in the book, and I've certainly discovered that on the college level when I teach the book. Many male students have told me they, you know, they probably wouldn't have picked it up on their own, but they're so glad that they read it.
And let's talk a little about the literary context for the book. You say it was a real departure from the sort of books produced for young readers at the time.
It was. And I think that context is really important for us to reconstruct. And it tells us, I think, why this book was so popular and why it still resonates, because these characters, these March sisters, these four girls, were very real little girls. I mean, you could hear their voices on the very first page, four distinct voices with distinct personalities. And this was highly unusual. Girl characters were not represented as individuals. They were meant to represent the vices and virtues of their sex. And they weren't given individual personalities the way the March sisters are. And so the March sisters sort of leap off the page as very real people. And not only that, but they're allowed to grow and change over the course of the book. They're not sort of perfect from the beginning. They're not meant to be models of, you know, good, sweet, virtuous behavior. They're full of flaws, and they're trying to improve themselves, and they're trying to figure out what kind of young women they want to be. And I think what's so striking is that Louisa allows them to grow up in their own individual ways. And to send the message in this book that there isn't just one way to become a woman was really very radical, and I think still a very radical message.
I learned from you that some critics saw the book as vulgar, and the Brits disliked its American slang, so some of that was cut for the English edition. And the only comparable hit was Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Right, yes. I think it's important to remember that, you know, for us Americans, that Little Women is not just an American book. It had a transatlantic success from the very beginning. It was, even though there were some British reviewers who were, I would say, a little snobbish about the language, readers adored it and loved it. And I think the recent BBC adaptation, there have been previous BBC adaptations over the years, suggest how much this book is claimed by Brits as much as it is by Americans.
Jo's appeal is, as you point out, her unconventionality, but as you note, there have been many attempts to mould her along more traditional lines, and, readers would demand that she marry, and film and TV directors would make her beautiful.
Yes, I don't feel that Jo has ever really been translated onto screen. I think the recent BBC adaptation probably came closest in Maya Hawke's portrayal. I'm really, really curious to see what the Greta Gerwig film does with Jo, because I think there's some real possibilities for allowing Jo to be a real, like as I was saying before, a real girl and not a Hollywood actress, not someone playing a role, not someone who is, you know, meant to be, adored and, appreciated for her beauty, which, you know, Hollywood actresses typically are. And it would be really nice to see Jo translated to the screen in the way that Alcott conceived of her. And she's quite clear in the book that none of them are beauties. Meg is actually the one who is prettiest and is described as somewhat of a beauty, but the other girls aren't. And it would be nice to see them conveyed as more real people on the screen.
Now, Alcott didn't want Jo to marry and didn't get married herself, but she had to give in to readers' demands.
She did. But she would not give in to the demand that Jo marry Laurie. That's what all the young fans writing to her wanted, because it's important for us to remember that, especially us in America, that Little Women was published in two parts. And it is still published in those two parts, Little Women and Good Wives, elsewhere. But in America, they're printed together in one volume. And so the first part was published in September of 1868. The second part came many months later in the spring of 1869. And so in between, she was getting all these letters from fans wanting to know what happens to the girls when they grow up. And they were particularly interested in who the girls marry. And she didn't like that very much. She said, as if that were the only end and aim of a woman's life. She wanted Jo to remain a literary spinster like herself. That was the term that she used. But didn't feel that she would be allowed to do so. So she decided to give her what she called a funny match, fully expecting vials of wrath to be poured upon her head, as she wrote. And in many ways, it has been. I think readers over the years have been generally pretty unhappy that Jo rejects Laurie and marries Professor Bear. In fact, I'm teaching the book right now again this semester, and we just had a big discussion about it today. All the students are very upset and wondered, why does she marry the stodgy old professor? But I think there are a lot of interesting arguments to be made for her settling down finally with the man who is who's older and wiser and more settled than Laurie, and will be a really good father to her children, and is poor, right? She doesn't want to marry a rich man like Laurie. She wants to be able to help earn the living and have something to do. And so Professor Bear, I think, was more than just a funny match. He was, in some ways, Alcott's ideal match for Jo.
I didn't realize, because I haven't seen it, that in the first film, Katharine Hepburn played Jo. Now, that seems to be, on the face of it, a reasonably astute piece of casting.
Well, yeah, Katharine Hepburn thought of herself as Jo March growing up. She also adopted a male name growing up, like Jo does. And she was very much the tomboy and didn't very much like being a girl, at least not in the traditional sense. And so she really saw that as her role. And she does play it beautifully in many ways. But I think, you know, for us looking at it now, we can see there's sort of this almost campish element to her. She's, you know, sort of overdoing or overplaying the tomboy elements to the extent that they don't seem quite natural. But in many ways, she was born to play Jo, I think, and she certainly felt she was.
Gillian's film, Gillian Armstrong's Jo, was Winona Ryder. And so even in what was a pretty feminist version, she had to be beautiful.
Yes, I love that film. That was the film that, you know, that I saw when I was, you know, had just discovered Little Women when I was in my early 20s. And I've seen it so many times, and it's just beautiful. It's just gorgeous. I mean, it really just sort of captures the essence of what we love about the book. My favorite scenes when all the sisters are on the bed with all the kittens running around on top of them. And there's just this beautiful sort of sisterly affection between them. But then she also gets at the tensions between the girls too, and shows us some of that that we don't see in earlier adaptations. But what I think is unfortunate is that Winona Ryder is so beautiful and seems to me on screen, at least, very aware of her beauty. And that's just not Jo. Jo's not even aware of being looked at and being observed. She is herself the observer looking out at the world. And there are times when I feel like Winona Ryder's Jo is meant to be looked at rather than be the observer herself.
In different eras, as we've already discussed, the story has been altered for radio, stage and screen to suit changing sensibilities. And Gillian Armstrong was certainly trying to do that. I understand that the screenplay, for example, was entirely, or the dialogue was entirely written. It didn't derive from the book.
Most of it, right. Most of it was not from the book. Robin Swycord, the screenwriter, talked about having kind of allowed the screenplay to be more of what she thought Louisa might have written if she felt freer to say what she wanted to say. And so she looked into her life and her other writings, her personal writings, for clues to, you know, Louisa's real feelings about things. And that comes through in the film, which is really lovely in many ways. But I think what concerned me was that there were opportunities missed to pull out from the book what was itself very progressive in the book, such as the passage where Marmee talks about her anger and shows that she has flaws too and things that she's struggling with. And you know, she's not the perfect mother. I feel like Susan Sarandon in that film is really so, is almost idealized to an extent that I feel like Marmee is not in the book. So there were some missed opportunities, but I think it's really interesting that Robin Swycord is involved as a producer in this new Greta Gerwig adaptation, as is Amy Pascal, who was, I believe, the lead producer on Gillian Armstrong's film. The fact that they're interested in having it remade tells me that they understand that the story really has to be retold again for a new generation, and that for every classic story like this, in order for it to live, it has to be retold and reimagined and re-envisioned for new generations.
When the book was first published, Alcott was given her dues as an author, but it seems in the years following, critics attacked its literary cred. Can you spell out some of the arguments for and against?
Well, for many years, the book, I think, was sort of, if we could say, doomed to popularity. It was considered such a popular book that it wasn't something you could analyze or criticize. It wasn't really accessible to literary criticism, so why bother even talking about it? That was the scholarly perspective. It was hugely popular in schools. And certainly meant a lot to so many readers. But I think over the years, what has happened is that it's become a sort of pigeonholed as a private book for girls. This was a phrase that a teacher used to me, and not something that was really meant to be discussed outside of, you know, girls' private bedrooms, essentially. Or maybe, you know, they read it with their mothers, but still it was something meant for private, for the private domestic sphere, not for public discourse. That I think is still that is the popular perception of the book. And I think it's extremely unfortunate, because what it does is it suggests that stories about women's lives are not something that we should all be concerned about or interested in. But at the same time, with the rise of feminist criticism and the access of women to higher education, and as they moved into positions as professors and literary critics, literary scholars, they have found in the book so much to talk about. And in fact, it was one of the key texts that really was instrumental in developing early feminist literary criticism. Many of the early feminist critics wrote about the book and analyzed it and understood that it was a key text in terms of thinking about women's literature. And over the years, their perceptions of it have evolved somewhat. But early on, the early feminist critics were very divided over the book. Many of them thought of it as a book that taught women how to become little, right? That it wasn't a book that was about growing up, but growing down. That Jo in particular was stifled in the book because she burned her writings and got married. And I think there were rather, in some cases, kind of unnuanced views of the book. The book is actually quite ambiguous, I think, and quite complex, and can be read in many different ways.
But isn't that one of the measures of its real significance, that it can be as endlessly debated as Hamlet?
Exactly. That is exactly the point that I try to make, that this book has generated so much debate and so much discussion. We still don't agree. Is Jo March a progressive figure, or is she ultimately stifled and you know, turned into a submissive domestic creature because she gets married? I still see it in my students. My students read it in radically different ways. And because it's a book that we can talk about, new adaptations can be made, new interpretations made all the time, that is what makes it a living text, I think.
I note that James Baldwin was very grumpy about it. I mentioned earlier Uncle Tom's Cabin. He compared it to Uncle Tom's Cabin, and rather aggressively.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure whether or not James Baldwin read Little Women, whether but he obviously read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that essay, Everybody's Protest Novel, is very much an attack on Uncle Tom's Cabin and the sentimentalism that it represents. And in his attempt to sort of explain what he means to his readers about the sentimentalism in the text, he compares it to Little Women, which I assume in the 1960s, was a more familiar text to them than Uncle Tom's Cabin was, because it had really fallen out of favor. So I see him as using it as a kind of shorthand, and I think it had certainly in popular culture become known as a tremendously sentimental text by that time. And it wasn't until it came to light that Louisa May Alcott had not only published children's literature, but she'd also published under pseudonym A.M. Barnard all of these pretty racy thrillers that include, you know, kidnapping, mistaken identities, lots of drug use, brides, you know, held up in the attic somewhere, you know, different really things that we wouldn't expect from the writer of Little Women, that, you know, feminist critics in particular started noticing the kind of undercurrents in Little Women that suggest it's a darker text than we realize. And this isn't simply sentimental, that there's some stark realism here too, that suggests how fraught the institution of marriage was, or, you know, how careful girls had to be when they got married. There's this line, in fact, where Meg's husband, John, tells her, she, you know, confesses that she spent a lot of money on a new dress. He says, "Don't worry, I won't beat you." And it's kind of this offhand line, but it reminds us, I think, that he could if he wanted to, because, you know, women were their husband's property. So your choice of a husband was so crucial in terms of your future happiness. The entire rest of your life was determined on whether or not you chose a good man or, you know, a man who would beat you. And so there are lots of ways, I think, in which we can notice things in the text that we wouldn't have noticed before, now that we know so much more about the kind of writer that she was, not just a children's writer.
Being a provincial, I'm groping for Australian connections. We have one in Gillian Armstrong, but there's another in Germaine Greer, whom I'm talking to tomorrow. Germaine likes the book, doesn't she?
She does. She said some really, really nice things about it when the 94 film came out that I quote in the book. She and Gloria Steinem both are two, you know, pretty staunch feminists who have not turned against the book the way other feminists have in the past. And I think it speaks to the deep affection they had for the book and the realization that, you know, this book had a real impact in terms of helping them develop their own feminist principles.
It's great to talk to you, Anne Boyd-Roux, Professor of English at the University of New Orleans and author most recently of Meg, Joe, Beth and Amy, the story of Little Women and why it still matters. And we are now entirely convinced by Anne that it does.